So those reports of sightings of her, they may be true?
Well, this is Ennis. Nobody ever really leaves.
Drop it!
Duncan and Buck come correct.
My older brother was talking about going to... he's never been to America, and he quite fancied going to New York in December for like Christmas and all the rest. And I was like, not this year. I was like, if I was you, I avoid America for at least the next year, next year and a bit. I was like, that post-election thing, whichever way it goes, there's going to be fucking anarchy.
One way or the other, yes, it is. It's going to be a real mess. But like, you know, I mean, here's the thing: is if the Democrats lose, there's going to be they will
accept the loss.
Right. It'll be protests in the streets and marches and that kind of shit. But that's going to be kind of the extent of it.
Yeah, a precedent has been set, though, Bo. Right. You can just like take up arms, and you know, the worst that'll happen is it'll take 2, maybe 3 years, and you'll do a little bit of time that someone will get you off with. So yeah,
isn't that great? Sounds sexy. I like the sound of that.
I know, always sexy.
Speaking of stuff that
sex?
Yeah. Speaking of the sex, no. So this is my spring break. I'm off this week, and
woo! Yeah, which, spring break.
Man, I was so fucking tired. I was angry at the kids when I left with some reason. With some, like, it wasn't just like free floating anger.
Yep. I do like the version of you get ready to go and just play the game, and you know what your problem is.
Man,
Steve, you're a real shitty kid, Steve.
But I mean, kind of. There are some real shitty kids. Like the reason I was angry was it was the day before spring break started, and I was like, "Hey, we're just gonna play a game, and I'll give you some bonus points." And it was like we were playing Balder Dash. Have you ever played that before? Where you
I know what the term Balder Dash means.
It's there's also a variation that Jackbox uses called Fibbage, but it's basically you're given a real word that is kind of kooky, right? And then you make up a definition for it, and if you guess the right definition of the word, you get a point. Get points if people believe your crazy definition. That's the game. And we're having a great time up until sixth period, when one of the kids just decides to be a real asshole about everything. And I'm like, you're fucking this up, like, this whole time.
We had a good thing going here.
Yeah. Like, you know, how many times do the words, "we're gonna take it easy today," come out of my mouth? Never. Yeah. Fucking never. Because I'm, like, I have a reputation for being kind of a hard teacher. And I like that reputation. Mm. And, but anyway, so sixth period was a bunch of assholes. And... and then my seventh period was a bunch of assholes too, and I discovered in between that one of the kids had completely ripped off the essay he turned in from another class, because it wasn't AI. God bless him. He didn't use AI. He just copied it from somebody else. The problem,
good old fashioned copy. I love it.
Yeah, but the problem was that class had an entirely different prompt for their essay. So when I read it, I'm like, this is not what your class was assigned. So like, it was just like this confluence of events that really pissed me off. And so when I walked out the door on Friday, I was just like, I was angry at the kids for pissing me off, because I was in such a good mood up until the end of the day. And I'm like, a couple of them really fucked it up for me. Which, you know, I'm only human, right? Like, I'm not gonna penalize the kids or anything, but sometimes they piss you off, man. Like, you have kids, you know how it is. It's
every now and again,
a kid will just be kind of shitty, and you're like, you're being kind of a shit, and you're making life worse for everyone around you right now.
My eldest is, like, too smart for her own good. Like, at the moment, and she knows she's smart. So the rebuttals at the moment are from someone that thinks that, and then sometimes she is right, but she forgets that I control everything. So, I've told her more than one time, pick your fight wisely.
Yes.
Like, because like this right now, even if you get the moral high ground at the end of this one, iPad is gone. You're not chatting to your friend. Like I wield that power, right? Yeah. I am the authoritarian state in this household. So like wield your words wisely next. So yeah.
But you know, again, short-sightedness is kind of part of the bag when you're talking about kids that like will just shoot themselves.
Time is nothing like to right. 9-year-old. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I have to remind myself every now and again, like, you know, this is a 14th of their life.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, like... that's a lot. And so I have to like,
yeah,
I have to check myself every now and again because you get so frustrated because you're like, you dumb shits, this is important because if you don't know this stuff, you're going to end up working a job that's not going to pay you anything.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to work twice as hard or half as much.
Mm-hmm.
And this doesn't matter. I'm like, all right, I'll fucking see you the next time I need my gutters cleaned, I guess.
Yeah, I tell you right now, one day, 15 years from now, you're going to be like, I wish I'd just listened to that class at Mr. Ransdon's. Just follow these, like that. You don't want to be a footnote in someone's kind of, I wish I had instead of.
So. Yeah, yeah. And you know, you talk to people, like there's a guy that works as part of the maintenance staff at the school.
Mm.
And one of the things he says over and over again, like we talk about a lot, about just how the kids are like, you know, they don't listen to shit because they know everything. And he's like, I wish I could tell him. He was like, man, I didn't grow up wanting to work at, you know, a high school maintenance job. He was like, it's not terrible, but that's not what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And he was like, but I fucked around. And at a certain point, you just, and that's why I tell the kids, I'm like, look, you have to start making decisions about what your life is going to be because either you make those decisions or somebody else will.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, again, mostly falls on deaf ears. you try to impart a little wisdom, and they're just like, I don't care. But I did, like, I had a write-up a kid. The asshole in sixth period told me that he didn't care about me or the game. I could go fuck myself. And I was like, all right.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, I don't argue about it. I'm like, okay, yeah, like I know where this goes, and what this means is you will be talking to an assistant principal soon, and if I'm very lucky, you're going to be gone for about 4 days, which would be great. That would be great for all of us. But it's like you talk about the power. It's like, hey, man, you can act out however you want, but at a certain point, you just get bounced out of here.
So. Yeah, that's literally what happens. Like,
So, you know, keep it the fuck up. That makes my life easier. But over spring break, I got to tell you another thing I did.
Yep.
So my dog, because, you know, I go off to school and I'm there for many hours, and my dog has a little bit of separation anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to the vet about it, and the vet was like, hey, there's kind of two solutions for this. Well, really three. One is you don't leave. And that's not.
That's not doable.
Yeah, right. Not feasible. And the second one is we give your dog medication, basically dope him up during the day and then
calms him down.
Right. And the problem isn't giant. It's just he likes to chew on pillows and shit like that. He gets anxious and chews on shit. But no cords or anything super valuable. Like every now and again, I got to replace a $20 comforter. He was like, so we dope him up, or he was like, but the downside of that is, you know, you're doping up your dog for no good reason, and you're not there if there's anything that goes wrong, and my dog's a little bit older, and blah, blah, blah. So he was like, the final solution, not the one you're thinking, Duncan, the other solution.
Did his hand start to levitate up?
Yeah. Pulling it down like Strangelove. The final solution for your dog.
It all of a sudden acquired a German accent.
Yeah. You know, like... yeah. Mm. It is quite a struggle with your dog. I know I have struggles too.
Yeah, I wrote them in this book. You may have read of it, Mein Kampf.
So anyway, the other solution was, he was like, he could try getting another dog because it'll just keep him company. And he was like, honestly, you've got a dog and they're not that, like, having two is really not an exponential amount of work.
It's really not like the like, once you understand the effort of one dog, it's not like kids. Once you understand the effort of one dog, two dogs is not that much more.
Right.
It's more food.
Slightly more expensive, but you know. So I've been auditioning dogs. And
like you just
What next?
Yeah, like if you get an audition dog, you need to watch yourself. If it comes in carrying a burlap sack,
ticky, 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 ticky.
You need to get out of there.
I was thinking more chorus line, like just sitting in a theater. Next.
Hello, Mahani.
Right. Aruru. Next. I don't like the emotion on the sleeve like that. Anyway, so we've tried dog number one. And I wanted to do this while I was here for spring break, so I had a few days to kind of spend with the dog and, you know, because it's not just Johnson, but there's the cat and, you know, let's make sure that's not a nightmare and that it's not pissing shit all over the place and that kind of thing. And so dog number one kind of came out of nowhere. And because I was planning on doing this actually over the summer, and then like kind of a friend of a friend from school was like, hey, I know some people who are giving away this beautiful chocolate lab.
Mm-hmm.
Would you be interested? And I was like, I was going to kind of wait, but I am off for the next few days and that might work out. So in comes Remy, the chocolate lab for.
Remy. Oh, I love it.
And she's beautiful and sweet. And like, it's like having a little Tasmanian devil loose. I'm like, she is just knocking shit over. Things are falling off walls. Like it was fun to have her. But it was also like, this is not the energy I'm looking for.
Yeah.
she's a lot. So Remy goes back. And then we're on dog number two now.
Mm-hmm.
Dog number two is named Cash.
Yep.
And so Cash.
Hi, Tango is Cash. It's Cash Tango. Tango Cash. These two cats drive me nuts. Did you swap into Palance? Did you go full Palance?
Yes. Because what I'm thinking is as soon as I go to check out the dog yesterday, and as soon as I see the name, because like I went to a shelter and there were like three different dogs that looked like they could be good fits, and I wanted to introduce my dog to them and see how that goes. And so Cash was dog number one. Johnson and Cash get along pretty well. Like they're kind of indifferent to one another, but it's like, okay, that's fine. So Cash is coming home, but the entire time I knew I was going to hang out with this dog Cash, and I'm thinking of, you know, Tango Cash, and I'm like, okay. So I'm thinking, well, clearly Cash is not his real name.
Yeah.
The real name of the dog in my head is Marion Wagetti, and everyone calls him Cash. I'm so glad you found it as funny as I did, because I was fucking delighted, Duncan. And so I've caught myself, because and he's been mostly really good, but the couple of times that, you know, he sniffed something and acted like he was going to pee on it or something,
yeah.
I'm like, Wagetti? Like, I'm the chief, you know?
Yeah.
And it's pretty fun.
Yeah.
So he is currently lying by my feet and really stinking up the joint because he hasn't had his bath yet. And he smells like the fucking pound. But he's a real sweetheart of a dog. he's still freaked out a little bit, of course. So
yeah,
you know, we're working on the cat thing, but other than that, he's been a real dream. So,
oh, amazing.
Yeah. So it seems like, and I was a little worried because on the way out, they were like, we've had a little trouble with this one.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how come? And they're like, well, he likes guns. they're like, well, he's not good with little kids. I'm like, that's fine. I don't have any of those.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, well, and he kind of got into it with a dog at another house. And he's been fine with Johnson. And so that hasn't been a problem, and you know, just keep an eye on it and whatnot. But so far, so good. I got like a 2-week trial period with this dog, so I can take him back for a full refund.
I like how you increased the volume of saying that when you knew he was at his feet.
Yeah. Yep, that's right, buddy. You can go back anytime. Not, I don't even have to have a good reason. I can just take him back.
Oh dear.
I like it. I think I told you this, but a buddy of mine for my birthday got me that cover of National Lampoon. Not the cover, but the whole magazine. The one with the dog on it.
Mm-hmm.
And literally it's hanging up in my bedroom, and last night the dog is in there and looks at that picture. And I was like, obviously it's a dog. It probably is not making any sort of association.
Mm-hmm.
But in my head, it's another like, oh fuck, what the, this guy got pictures of guns pointing at dogs later, and you're like, what kind of fucked up situation am I in right now? Am I in a hostel?
My pug used to irrationally bark when black people were on the TV, and I started Googling, is my pug, and I put the R, and it auto-corrected to racist.
Sure.
Like, straight away. And I haven't been able to work out why, but then it did occur to me, pugs come in two different colors, like that kind of fawny color or black. So I wonder if he sees that and associates it as pug.
Or just, you know, he grew up like
either that, or he is also in where your vent, like worshippers of the final solution. I don't know. One of the two, he might be full on.
When he's moving around the room, is it like little goose steps? Little corgi goose steps?
He does kind of like a paw comes up in front and down like that when he's walking.
A real crisp march, which you don't normally see in a pug. So anyway, this is Doug and Bo correct. We're talking about the finale, Duncan, the final episode of True Detective Season 4, what Issa Lopez has visited upon us.
Or as I like to call it, the episode that broke the internet.
You know, so this is the lowest rated of all the episodes, if you look at IMDb, which it seems fucking crazy to me.
Yeah, it's the lowest rated in terms of like people rating online.
Yeah.
But it's the highest watched episode of True Detective ever.
Sure.
Yeah, like this like if you want to break it down, there's a lot of people confused as to why Issa Lopez has been given another season of True Detective. Out with the fact that I think she nailed this, you have to take into account that every single episode, week on week, collected 15% more viewers over its entire six episodes.
Oh wow, that's impressive that it grew with each
like if you one, break yeah. down the if you break down the numbers, it's a 10-15% increase in viewership per episode. That's not overall for the season, it's per episode.
That's nuts.
So yeah, like they locked her in ASAP. Like that's why that news dropped. We were joking about on the previous recording. Like it was like the finale came out, and then 2 days later, it was like she's coming back for another season. And I was like, that seems a bit quick. And then like I did a bit of reading into the numbers. And if you are HBO or Max or whatever they're called now, you lock that down now. Like because no TV show
ring
does
on
that.
It. Yeah,
yeah. Like no TV show does that week on week. Well, that's almost unheard of, especially in an anthology terms, mm-hmm. like even things like American Horror Story, when it was at its peak, Zenith didn't do that. As a TV show carries on, you lose viewers, or people forget, or they're, I'll catch up with it in a couple of weeks, I'll bank the episodes or whatever. No. Like this, 10-15% week on week. It's the highest watched episode of True Detective was the finale, but that appears to have come with a little bit of internet backlash.
Well, and you know, for my money, and I mean, obviously, we're going to be getting deep, deep into this episode. Ooh, deep. But deep. but you know, Issa Lopez, I thought, pulled off a really neat trick, which is use all the stuff from the first season that people found fascinating and did the deep dives on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do that part of it, but also do these like clever, you know, little winky nods to horror movies, and then tell your own story. And
yeah,
like she did all of those things in a way that I found really fun and satisfying and interesting. And
yeah, I mean,
that's tough.
Yeah, there's one or two things that I thought were like clearly clumsy shoehorns from the first season, specifically in this last episode where I was like, right, okay. But if you do a little bit of reading on it, basically, and I mentioned this in the first episode that we reviewed, she went into HBO with a pitch for a TV show called Night Country, and they said, "We'll love it. How about True Detective Night Country?" Mm-hmm. And apparently she said at the time, "What's a true detective?" And they were like, uh-huh. And she went away, she watched season one, she fucking loved season one, and then rewrote the script and put, like, you know, put bits in that would kind of give it... I think it is less... I look at it more of it's trying to ground it in the same universe rather than this is a direct continuation or being joined. I think the comparisons or the things that tie the stuff together is done in a way where I don't think it's egregiously saying you need to pay it. Like we mentioned this before, like if you watched season one of True Detective, I mentioned it at the time, like clearly says that Russ and Cole did not die of, you know, leukemia or whatever it was. Like, he didn't have that. He never had that disease. Yet in season four, he had that disease. Tuttle was a smaller regional thing in season one, it's a conglomerate in season four. So it's using terminology, but it's like even the spirals go a different way in this season. So it's almost like a mirror of that. And you can go one step further and say season one is in the Texas sun. You know, it's warm, it's humid and all the rest. And this one is vastly dark and cold. It's like it's almost a mirror image. And as a result, if you take it that way, the hints of things more horror or esoteric in season one are far more predominant in their horror, and so it's almost like the mirror image of it.
Mm-hmm.
So from that point of view, the fact that two women instead of two guys, like if like you go down that road, you want to go one step further, let's go one step even further than that. Who saves the day? This the women that are wronged. So it's almost a mirror image of season one in a lot of respects, and I think there's two things that we need to kind of take into account when talking about True Detective. And I think it's more evident now that Nick Pizzolatto was no longer there. And I think once we grasp this and understand this, I think like you either are on board or you're not. And the thing I think we need to take into account is there are some people that cannot see past season one and will never be able to see past season one. And that's fine. Season one is an incredible season of television, arguably one of the best ever made, like front to back. It's just absolutely incredible, but they can't see past that, right? So like if it's not season one, then it's okay. you know it's a mockery of the name, right? They don't understand what an anthology is, right? There's that. And then there's the other part, which is I think there's a lot of people out there that did not want this to succeed because they see this as, and then my eyes will almost roll in the back of my head and not come back, as some sort of woke agenda TV show because it's all about female empowerment and all the rest. And I think if that's your read from this, when you come away at the end, you are a lazy, lazy, lazy person.
Yeah, and not understanding that the characters in this show are deeply flawed. Like, there's 100%
flawed.
Right, there's not a hero to be found. It's, no, like, I mean, there is, but it's not, like, they're not, like, we've got girl power, we can solve this. It's like, they're doing it for their, like, the most human of reasons.
Yeah. This is haunted them. Like, this is like an actual physical haunting as opposed to the kind of esoteric haunting that's in the show. Like, Issa Lopez said in an interview, kind of post this show coming out, that she wanted to highlight the fact that Indigenous women, and there's plenty of cases, of like the stories now are everywhere, Indigenous women can be murdered, they can be raped, they can phone for help from law authorities, and they are unseen. They are disregarded. And I think she pulled off maybe arguably the greatest masterstroke ever in this TV show by making the most obvious prominent candidates in this one, in this season, the killers that even the audience disregards all the way right through. We spoke about this in the second episode where I'm like, the fingerprint thing, missing fingers, and we're like, yeah, but how would, and it, that was parked. And we went off on this. We went off on the fucking the red web conspiracy of, you know, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. Maybe like all down all these roads, and ultimately, when it swings back round to give you its answer, she hit the nail on the head. Like, she gave you the most plausible explanation of all, really, and it worked. There's a couple of things she's left spooky, and I kind of love that about it. And I very much am looking forward to see what she does when writing truly a true detective TV show moving forward, and not a story that she's co-opting True Detective into. And that's what I'll say up front. I thought this landed really, really well. So much so that I would rank this as my second favorite. No, third. Sorry, third favorite season of True Detective. So.
This is probably my second favorite season overall.
Nice.
I was talking to a friend at work about this, the finale in particular, and she kind of summed up, I think, how I felt about it, which was, I enjoyed the finale so much, it made me like the rest of the season even more.
It ties it all in.
Yes, and it was...
It ties it all in, and not in a way where you're like, oh yeah, that was the guy that was cutting the lawn. Like, they do... I forget that every single time that you see him, like, really early on, and he's a bad guy. It's a Scooby-Doo thing, you know what I mean? Like, you see, like, the lighthouse keeper right at the beginning, and then you see him at the end when he's unmasked. Or the giallo thing. Like, I mentioned giallo because I've not mentioned it in a recording in a while. The giallo thing of it's the character you walk past right at the beginning. Like, it's that way where it's in front of your face, but it's inconsequential, so you disregard it, right? And then you go in for the big conspiracy, which is far sexier, right? And then the ultimate reveal is the thing that makes the most logical sense.
We were asking the wrong questions, Duncan.
We were, and it was, see, when they did, I was like, oh.
I know, it was so good. Just
hit me
so
in all good. The sweet spots. Jodie Foster, by the way, is, like, hands down fucking incredible in this episode. Like, just give her awards. Throw the awards at her.
She's got a delivery, and I've got, we'll talk about it when we get to that point in my notes, but there is one delivery that she has in this that is maybe my favorite Jodie Foster delivery ever.
She is, like, just across, like, the whole arc of her character, not even just in the whole season, just this episode is chef's kiss.
Yeah.
It is phenomenal. And I was reading, because I've been reading up loads on this, people go that, you know, and surprisingly, Jodie Foster, I'm like, she's got a fucking Oscar. I mean, what are we doing here?
Right, yeah, like, don't call it a comeback, all right? Yeah, like Jodie Foster has been legit. Hey, have you ever seen fucking through. Panic Room?
I know, like across the board, like, she does not phone it in. She's never, yes, she's been in some shitty movies. I'm looking at you, Elysium. Like, she's been in some shitty movies, but she's never shitty. Like, she always commits to the role. And when you hear, once again, from the reading and all the rest, like Jodie Foster, like, had specific views on how she wanted to play this character, and one of them was she wanted to age the character. This character was supposed to be younger and she wanted a more aged, time weathered, grizzled, gnarled, and all the rest. Like she, I think she may have also added the alcoholism in there as well as an element to the character that she brought to the table, which, once again, Issa Lopez, well done. Like, you're listening to Jodie Foster, Academy Award winning Jodie Foster, and her comments on a character and incorporating that in. It's just,
Well, I mean, there's a reason that you hire Jodie Foster, and it's not so that you can tell her how to do her job.
No,
you
know, it's
yes, you have been doing this, you've been playing this game for 50 years now.
Yeah.
You know what the fuck you're doing. What do you think this character needs? Great, let's do that.
Let's do that, yeah.
You know, and her instincts are right. Like, this is one, her character is one of my favorite characters, I think, in anything ever. Yeah. I love how flawed she is and I just love everything about her. I love the fact that she is fighting for a thing because that's what there is to do.
Yeah.
And she fucks it up a lot, but she keeps at it. And there's something like noble about the character. Like from the first episode, it's like, oh, she's going to be like almost the Sherlock Holmes kind of character. Yeah. It's like, well, yeah, if Sherlock Holmes had a weird sex addiction and was alcoholic and has this horrible relationship with her daughter and is haunted. Yeah. I mean, it's just like,
she's the embodiment of the line in the episode where she says, was it, you'd be surprised what humans can overcome, or you could be surprised what a person can
Live
through.
Yeah. You'd be surprised what a person can live through. Yeah.
Yeah. Like she is the embodiment of that as a character. Like, I'm like, she's saying it and like, preach. Like,
and so we start, we'll get into this in a minute, but you know, we're just champing at the bit.
It's too difficult not to. You're gonna ask me what my good is. I have not watched anything bad. My good is Dune 2, which is like hands down a sci-fi masterpiece. Is fucking unreal.
Okay, for a second I thought you said June 2, and I was like, what was June?
That June 2 is July. Okay. So that's what that is. It's June squared.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Yeah, Dune 2, Denis Villeneuve returning to close out the second half of the first book of Dune. Proving, I think without a shadow of a doubt now, that he's the finest science fiction director of the last 50 years. This is the murderer's row this guy has now been on is Arrival, Blade Runner 2049, Dune, and Dune 2. And this one is the most ostentatious. This is the very definition of blockbuster. It is. It looks gorgeous. It's the Hans Zimmer score, maybe my favorite Hans Zimmer score. The visual effects, the storytelling. Christopher Walken plays the emperor, and he's Christopher Walken. Right? This is the thing. He's not trying to play. He's Christopher Walken. He's like when fucking Alexander the Great is played by Sean Connery in Time Bandits, and you're like, he's like, hello, I'm Alexander, and you're like, you're supposed to be Greek, and it's not.
It turns out there are no more worlds to conquer.
It's like it's that way where he appears, you just like that. Oh, this is Jim.
Yeah.
It is absolutely jaw-droppingly good, and it's going to make all the money. I think this is the one that's going to. I think this is the one that's just going to mean that Denis Villeneuve can do anything he wants for the rest of his career. I think it still holds the highest rating on IMDb ever given. It has dethroned Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, wow.
And that's, I have literally to meet someone who has not come out of it and said, that was incredible.
Until now, Duncan.
Yeah.
Now, I'm actually going to see it on Saturday, and I'm excited because...
There's a section in the movie where you go to the Harkonnen homeworld. and you're introduced to
what is Austin. The name of that planet again? Leto Prime? No, that's Atreides. What
that's
is
that's Atreides?
I can't. It's got a cool name, and I can't remember the name of it.
Well, they go to anyway, and it's monochrome.
Oh, it's just black and white.
The whole thing's shot in black and white.
Oh, that's fucking crazy. It's, what a great idea. So like the idea being that the atmosphere filters out all colors.
I have no idea. I don't fucking explain it. And I just sat there and like my jaw was on the ground go at that. Right, this is like a like we're gonna like once we step out into the sun, it's gonna no. They shot it using it's an X-ray something. I can't remember. There was a big piece on how he shot it using this technique that you don't usually see. And yeah, the whole scene, as you're introduced to his nephew, who was played by Sting in the original one, who's played by the dude that played Elvis in that Elvis movie, right, Austin. Right. And he's introduced in at this point, and the whole planet, like, there's a huge amphitheater thing where a fight that it's just, it is fucking, like, you're sitting watching this, and you're just like, what, wait, how did we, what did we, how did, fucking head explodes everywhere. Yeah, next level storytelling.
So, Getty Prime is the Getty Prime. That's the plan. That's great. What a great idea. That's fucking cool.
And I will tell you no more about it, but I will say this: you will fucking love it.
You know, we've talked about Dune before, but that much like Zodiac, that is just a movie that I can throw on and I just wallow in.
Yeah,
and it's wonderful. I love all the nooks and crannies of it. It's just like now I just want to watch Zodiac again. I'll probably watch Zodiac tonight.
But I have nothing else that I want to bring to the conversation today. I was really kind of preoccupied. Pretty much all of my time since watching it has just been like, this is yeah.
So my good is actually a book.
Oh.
A while back I finished this, but I want to bring it up again because it's so fucking good. Mm-hmm. But it's a book called Boys in the Valley, by an author named Philip Fracassi, Fracassi, uh-huh. Who I'd never heard of before, never read anything by the guy before. But this is one of my favorite horror novels I've read in some time. I try to read about two a month.
Yeah.
And anyway, it's a little bit Evil Dead.
Uh-huh.
It's a little bit Exorcist. And it's a little bit...
See, if you say country, I'm out.
No. So the premise is in like turn of the 20th century, so like like early 1900s, and it's a Franciscan run or a priest run orphanage just out on the prairie, you know, kind of a little bit away from town. And one night, as the snow comes in, Duncan, some guy shows up with, you know, in custody of the police, wounded, gravely wounded.
Uh-huh.
And the guy should be dead by all accounts. By everyone looking at him, they're like, this dude should be fucking dead, and he's not. And then finally he does die, but only after like saying some shit about priests and then expiring in a way that knocks like a crucifix off the wall and stuff like that. And so that's kind of the beginning of it. And then a bunch of the kids at the orphanage start to act pretty weird.
Right.
And so you get this kind of siege moment where there are a bunch of these, you know, orphans. And you know how I love a good killer orphan, Duncan. But there are a bunch of killer orphans running around, like, being evil and shit. And a few survivors trying to survive this. But it's just, it's so well written. It's so much fun. It's kind of mean-spirited. Even the end is dark in a way that is satisfying without being completely nihilistic. And anyway, it's super good. Eventually, somebody will make a bad movie of it. But the book is I'm telling you right now, go check out the book Boys in the Valley. It's scary, it's fun, it's thrilling. Like, it's one of those like real page turner kinds of books, and was a tremendous amount of fun. So that's my good for the week. I know you said you didn't have anything bad, but I'll take care of this, Duncan. Because I saw Aquaman 2.
Oh, why would you even put yourself through that?
I'll tell you, the reason is because I'm like, hey, this is the last hurrah of that DCEU stuff. You know, like The Flash is out. Aquaman 2 is kind of the last, like, post-James Gunn or pre-James Gunn DC stuff that you're going to get. And so I was just curious, like, how are they going to send this out? And it turns out with a big wet fart, because nobody cares. And James Wan directing again, which is interesting. I'm glad he's making his big nut. And there are moments where it's like, oh, this feels like a James Wan kind of thing, because this little thing is kind of creepy or weird or whatever. But it is the most tired superhero shit. Which at this point, like, that alone is tired, and this is a tired version of that. I fell asleep for a good 20 minutes of that movie during the runtime and woke up and I was like, I clearly missed nothing, because we're just doing more of the same dumb shit. It's just a real bad movie. I'm glad whatever the new DC stuff is going to be, I'm sure it's going to be more in the vein of like, Suicide Squad, the James Gunn Suicide Squad, which is fun. And I imagine like the Superman will be more earnest and a little more like OG Christopher Reeve Superman, which is fine. Like, all of that is fine. But honestly, who could give a fuck? Like, who could care at this point? And Aquaman 2 is the thing that reminded me, like, oh, I just don't care about any of this anymore, and I need to never watch it again.
I did love there was an article. I think it was towards the end of last year where they were saying that superhero movies were underperforming and they couldn't quite work out why. And I was like, because it's four movies a year, every year, for the last almost 20 years. I mean, audiences will eventually... like, why? It's horror movie. Like, because it's different.
Mm-hmm.
It's one and done for the most part. Although that trend of... needless sequels is rising from the grave, much like a zombie. I mentioned this, I think, on the last recording. Why on earth anyone thinks it's a good idea to invest money in a Black Phone 2 is beyond me. Just give money to a different director to make something else that Joe Hill's written. Like, what we doing here? Like,
this is then slap like from the creators of the Black Phone all over it, and like, oh, I like that movie, let me go to this other movie.
100%. That's how you get me into the cinema.
Or even Smile 2, where I'm like, you know what? Smile was I really liked Smile. I had a great time with it. Don't need a sequel.
Yeah, it's one and done.
Yeah.
Why do we need to? Why do we need something that will not be as good as the thing that we just... Oh, look, have enough in there that'll make you remember why you enjoyed the first movie. and also why you don't enjoy this one.
Well, fuck all that noise, Duncan. Let's get into True Detective. That's why we're here. That's what we care
we're
about.
Here for it.
And
longest ever episode of True Detective. And I will say this, and when it comes to talking about this episode, actually, I don't think we're going to be talking for nearly as long as we've talked about some of the other episodes.
I agree. I agree.
Straight down to business, straight line storytelling. So
very much it does. Like, there are some things along the way that we'll definitely need to dig into. But for the most part, this is like, hey, we are getting answers to the questions that have been posed.
Yes.
And it starts off even with them, like when last we left our heroes. They were driving towards the ice caves, night country, if you will. And then we open the show with them busting through the ice to get to the ice caves. Mm-hmm. And we get the little insert, like, this is December 31st, the 14th day of night. And Navarro goes in first. Danvers comes in behind her. And then they start looking around in these ice caves.
Mm-hmm.
And then Navarro's spidey sense starts tingling, where she's like, oh, there's a ghost afoot. And so it, like, leads Danvers through the, like, all the, these kind of tight spaces and so forth. And Danvers is getting real pissed off. Like, God damn it, Nevarro. These are some real uncomfortable caves, Dr. Lecter. Let's get out of here. But all of this leads them to a collapsed tunnel.
Yeah, dead end.
Yeah.
So.
And Nevarro's like, can't you hear her? Like, I can hear Annie calling me. I know this is where it happened. We've got to figure this out. And then no sooner has Danvers insulted her for saying spooky shit again.
I hope you fall through the floor is what she says. And then all of a sudden she falls through the floor.
And, yeah. And down she goes like through the floor. And Danvers is like, all right, are you okay? Listen, Dr. Lecter, I'm going to go get help. And no sooner does the
she pee... Kinda, she does kind of lean over the edge right. of that. And then she's leaning over there. She's like, precious, precious.
Are you alone down there?
Come back, you fucking bitch.
Yeah. That's what Nevarro is saying. Why does this feel so familiar? Wait. Do you have night vision goggles on?
Yeah, like, Danvers is like 2 steps away from telling her how reckless she was, and then all of a sudden, floor gives way with her as well, and she goes face down.
Yeah, she hits hard, gives it a real like oof when she hits, which I really like. And as soon as they realize like, oh, she's okay, they see somebody fly by who they think is Clark, and they give chase. And Duncan, wouldn't you know it, we end up in like an underground ice lab.
Yes.
Like fucking Die Another Day. And there's a moment, I think it's Nevarro who's like, Danvers, look up. And they look up and they see the spiral shape made from fossils frozen into the ice above them.
That's a cool visual.
And then we go to credits because, you know, how do you get out of that scene where it's just like, look at this awesome shit. Just go to the credits. So what then after the credits are over, we join them back in this kind of underground lab in the cave lab. And the first thing they find is a murder weapon.
Yeah, like they pick up what looks to be like a drill bit, and the drill bit is cross-shaped, star-shaped, or whatever it was, and they're like, that reminds you of anything? So they take photograph for evidence. Mm-hmm. This would appear to be, if you're piecing things together, the murder weapon, which means that Annie Kay died here.
And Nevarro is pissed. As soon as she realizes, like, oh, this is probably the murder scene, she is, like, stalking around.
Yeah.
Like fucking Darth Maul. And then sees that there's this kind of scoop marks by this shelf of samples. And they pull that out. And sure enough, there's a ladder that goes up that leads into Duncan, the Salal station.
So how long were they in the caves?
I mean,
it must have been a while because this whole ordeal lasts an entire day. So this like episode is pretty much an entire day. But they must have done some, like, because one of the things that struck me about this one is when it's pointed out when fucking mad crazy German fucking
Otis Heiss,
when he was marking on the map, like, there was at no point they were like, look how close it is to Salal or anything like that at all. It looked to be isolated, but then this cave network could extend for miles. So it's conceivable they went down there, they followed the caves down. Because we don't, like, this is the beauty of the show. The show never really gives you an indication of time out with the date that comes up on the screen. Mm-hmm. But they must have traveled a bit of a distance anyway to ultimately be in the Salal station. So we basically have gone kind of full circle. We've ended right back where we started, which is kind of awesome. In more ways than one, because as they get out into the Salal station, Twist and Shout's playing again on loop.
Right, which of course Jodie Foster loves. Like, I love this song.
Like, she knows exactly how to get into that cupboard this time, so she ain't fucking around at all. God damn, she's not an opportunity. Listen here, Ralph, you can fuck my wife. You can sit in a postmodernistic bourgeois house and our, but one thing you can't do, there's one thing I want, you're gonna watch my motherfucking television! Fucking rips it against the wall. She literally opens this cupboard, grabs a fucking thing, tears it out, and yeah, Ferris Bueller has once again been discontinued.
And is there, there is a cutaway to Danvers' house where Pete is just cleaning up murder. And taking a shower to wash the blood off of him.
The blood of his father.
We will come back to that. But just a quick point, like, oh, that's going on in the background of all this other stuff. Yeah. Navarro is tracking these wet footprints that lead right into a wall. And Danvers, meanwhile, is tracking down, like, she sees some door swinging as, you know, Clark, is that you?
Yeah.
I'm a federal agent. And
hey, Starling, did you forget your... Always check the blind spot. Always check the blind spot.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Because <Like her. laughs> she doesn't check her blind spot, and as a result, she gets trapped.
She gets locked in a room. Like, she goes into a room, and part of the room is that they have, like, a freezer for all these ice cores that they've dug up. And she goes into that room, and Clark shuts the door on her.
Right,
because there's an outside control.
Instantly, what I thought when this happened is, right, this is how the scientist died. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's how my brain went. I was like, oh, right, walk-in freezer? Why did we not, like, why has this not been a theory before? Like, a blast freezer? Like, that totally makes sense. That's how they died. Turns out, no. I was wrong on that one.
Yeah. We'll get to that. In one of the, I love that whole scene. But anyway, so Clark is now on the loose in the station. Danvers is locked up in this core sample room. And Clark just goes full Jack Torrance with...
Well, that's it. This whole scene is Jack, like, is so fucking... Like, I love Issa Lopez. I really, really do. I love the fact that she just unabashedly went, oh, that, The Shining. Let's just lean right into it.
Right, so he brains Navarro with this fire extinguisher.
Scatman Carruthers, right,
Scatman Carruthers, her. And then she wakes up while she's being dragged, also from The Shining. Oh, really? And
what's she doing?
But in a real nice change of pace, Navarro, like, busts out. She finds, like, this iron rod in there, and, like, and busts out of the core sample room, gets out of this freezer, and goes to find Navarro, who is fucking this dude up, and she has to stop it. She has to, like, call time. She's like, don't kill him. Jesus Christ, Navarro. Come on, Dr. Lecter.
Yeah, like, in this scenario, the person that you wanted to keep locked up in the blast freezer might be Navarro, like, and then maybe brain Jodie Foster. You picked the wrong, but, like, fucking world champion boxing person, this actress, like, she is on top of him. She is smacking the shit out of him. But what I love about this is, like, Jodie Foster is not saving this guy.
No.
Like,
we need to ask him questions.
we're gonna ask him questions. Also, before we get to asking him questions, let's leave him with the tortured hills on loop, dude. Like,
it's so fucked up, details, man.
The details in this episode are just fucking incredible.
Yeah. So, I mean, well, let's just skip ahead to that, and then we'll come back to Pete. But yeah, so they duct tape him to a chair, and Navarro's like, "Did you love Annie?" And he's like, "Yeah, I loved Annie." And she's like, "Good." And then sticks headphones in his ears,
and then
duct tapes them.
Yeah, in there, and then plays her death video on loop. And then they put the tape over his mouth as well, and switch the light off, and then go to get a cup of coffee or something to eat, or like, well, we're just going to get. We'll just leave him like that, and leave him howling without a voice in the dark, listening to the death cries of his love. It's so fucking sinister.
It's raw.
Yeah.
I really like it. Meanwhile, let's check back in with Pete,
who's having a grand old time.
Finding a tooth embedded in the wall.
Most likely his dad's.
Most likely his dad's from when he shot his father molar through the face. Yes.
It's the closest, the molar is the closest we get to the term mole people in this episode, which once again shoots our theory out. But yeah, there's...
Molar people.
But it's stuck in the wall, and he looks at me, he's like, oh, I kind of need to, and then all of a sudden, fucking, like, Danvers kid comes in.
Leah, yeah, shows up and is just like, yeah, you know, is Danvers around? Like, we had a fight, and he's like, nope, everything's cool here. Just cleaning up around the house. Yeah, make myself useful, no big deal.
He's standing awkwardly like Tom Savini does from Dusk Till Dawn after being bitten.
Yeah. And Leah clocks it right away. She's like, what is wrong with you? What's going on here? He's like, well, you know, just everything going on with Kayla right now. And she's like, oh, yeah, I guess that's cool. And then he's like, you know what? In fact, can I just take you back there? Because the idea of them being alone on New Year's Eve kind of bumps me out. It would make me happy if, like, you're not, like, Danvers isn't here. She's off doing a work thing. Why don't I take you back there? And then you're there to keep her company and et cetera. And she's like, I guess?
Yeah, maybe. Okay. Yeah.
And
what's so that? You want me to turn my back for a couple of seconds? That seems unusual. Right, let me just face the door. Like, because as soon as she turns to walk out, he's like right around grabbing the tooth, going, fuck, I want you just come out. Fuck, whoa.
steam clams, you say. Yes, sir. That's what you call hamburgers. Yep, steamed hams. Anyway, so, yeah, like you said, there's a quick... like, yoink, as he grabs this tooth off the wall, which is, like you said, it's just a really gnarly detail to include.
It's a super gnarly detail. Like, you've just washed your father's blood off you after, like, wrapping him up in plastic, like she's Laura fucking Palmer, and putting her in the back of a vehicle to bury somewhere. And, like, you've just got through all that, and you're like, and now you've got to deal with this shit. And just as you're getting ready to go, dispose of your dad's body, you turn around and he's fucking tooth's embedded in the wall.
There, yeah, we'll get to a discussion about this later that I dearly love, because Navarro does not fuck around. She's just like, he's fucked for life, isn't he?
Yeah.
But we'll talk about that in a minute. Anyway, so he does take Leah back to Kayla's place. Mm-hmm. She runs in, and then out comes Kayla right away.
Because she knows there's something up.
Right. And he's like, look, I know this is fucked up, but there's a thing that I've got to do, and I can't tell you.
She says, what's Danvers got you doing? And she's like, Danvers didn't do anything. It's me.
Yeah, this is me. Yeah.
Yeah.
And as he's telling her, like, hey, once this is done, I'm with you 100%. Yeah. But I gotta do this thing. And before he can even get it all out, like, she kisses him and she says, look, just come home.
Yeah.
When all this is over, just come home. And so then we go back to Salal as this storm, by the way, I don't know if we mentioned this, but, like, there's the storm going on outside.
Massive Arctic storm, which you saw at the end of the previous episode that they were driving into. But this thing is fucking hellacious, right?
Yeah. And they make the point, like, hey, we can't go home until this is over.
Yeah.
And so they're stuck there, and they're playing, you know, the horrifying video for this dude in the taped to the chair.
Danvers is eating Funyuns, which, remember, we mentioned Funyuns right back in the first episode with the delivery driver bringing it. Yep. So she's having Funyuns.
Navarro, on the other hand, opens the fridge and out rolls an orange. And we learn that her mother loved oranges, and there's kind of a significance to that.
Yeah.
And Danvers, meanwhile, sees this bit of glass on the floor. Mm-hmm. And we get a split-second flash to her, like, walking along the pavement where there's a lot of broken glass.
Yeah.
Just for a second. And then when we cut back to her, she's kind of picked it out of her shoe and has thrown it. And this is where Navarro says, so is Pryor fucked for life?
Yeah.
That's how she puts it. Yeah. And that's where Danvers is like, maybe, I don't know. And she says, it's crazy the shit that we survive.
Yeah.
But now they're ready. There's a moment where they're like, so you think he's good? Yeah, let's go. Yeah. Let's go talk to him. And so they do, unceremoniously rip the duct tape off his hair, which I was like, this may be the most painful thing in this whole episode. But he's ready to talk now.
Yeah.
So he tells him that he did not kill Annie.
What I love about this, this is the theme of this entire season, is the stories that we tell.
Yes.
And we've had this all the way through. Like, I once again, I read some people complaining about the fact that, you know, he's saying one thing, but the, you know, they're playing kind of both sides here by showing you one version of the truth and his version of how he's, like, the way he tells it is his story, mm-hmm. as if they've not used this technique before in this season. Like, they literally have on the Wheeler case.
Yeah, or that it didn't begin with a made-up quote about an unreliable narrator.
Is a flat circle, but literally, they've been all the way through it. But yeah, like, the story that he tells is not what you as the audience see. So you hear his narration over actually what happened. And what you find out, Bo, is kind of what we had pieced together. Once again, I love the fact that we kind of worked out a lot of this. We may not put it all together at the end, but the show really did dangle a lot of really obvious shit in front of us. And we just didn't ask the right question.
Mm-hmm. But I feel like we mostly got it right from early on.
Like, so much of the stuff we got earlier, I think it's just because we are preconditioned to watch things and try to extract every nuance.
Yeah.
But yeah, ultimately what happened is the clip that we'd seen on the phone, right, with her screaming, is a small segment of her death, and it was in that room below. We find out that she was in a relationship with Clark. We already knew that. Mm-hmm. However, she somehow got into the facility, thus once again validating our theory that maybe she was using him to get access. She's an activist after all. Maybe she was already piecing things together. She needed access to Salal, so she started seeing Clark, who seemed a bit unstable anyway. So she got in there. During her time checking around, she managed to find the access to the lab. And, you know, when she went down there, she found all these papers that ultimately proved that the scientists were actively, and this is from his thing, he's like, because they're asking him about what the station does, and he's like, no, like, we found the cure. We found the thing, the enzyme, the organism, the whatever we want to call it. Like, it cures everything. We found it, but we couldn't extract it in good enough quantities in order for us to do this. But what we did find out is actually the mine, you know, it's pumping all this pollutant into the water. It's actually raising the core temperature, which is making it easier for it to do. So we kind of just turned a blind eye at that, fabricated some shit in order to do it. She found this evidence that basically the mine is the thing, which we already knew, which is behind all the stillbirths, all the problems and all the rest. And they were covering up. Her finding this, she then starts breaking the ice core samples, which the main guy, the head guy, the guy who like died in the worst pain in the hospital room, he found her doing that, and he just flipped. He did the old Sean Connery from, it's not Gorillas in the Mist. Is it Gorillas in the Mist? What's the movie where Sean Connery finds a cure for cancer?
Oh, Medicine Man. With Lorraine Bracco.
Found the cure for the plague of the 20th century. I've lost it.
Yeah.
He sees this and he grabs the first thing he can find, star-shaped chisel, starts stabbing her. She screams out. Clark hears this. Clark wakes up, runs through, runs down, sees her, tries to pull him off. He smacks her. Then apparently all the scientists come down and it's a real kind of, well, let's just hold her down. Let this guy finish it. And this is what we're seeing. So once again, we're seeing the validation of that part of the story. When he says that, you know, they all attacked her, they held him down, and I had to watch it. Like, that's what happened. What he doesn't tell them, but what we get to see, Bo, is she's not actually fucking dead.
Right. Because Clark is like clean air up and like, oh, this should never have happened. And she kind of wakes up and starts clawing at him for help. And he uses that same shirt or whatever he has to smother her.
Yeah, it does the old
Speaking of Nicholson, he gives her the old cuckoo's nest.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. He basically strangles her to death. So she died of asphyxiation. He's the guy that does it, but he doesn't tell them that. And actually, right to the point that he dies, he's still claiming that he loved her and he didn't kill her. So once again, that's a detail that we now know that the detectives don't know. But I think the fellow, he's responsible even by proxy, by virtue of not, he's an accessory. Even if, like, at the worst case, like, at the best case scenario is an accessory, worst case is a murderer.
And Navarro asks him about the tongue.
Yeah, so he says that, he says, like, he, like, they're like, that's, why did you cut out our tongue? And he's like, well, no, we never did that.
Like, right. Like, we did a lot of fucked up stuff, but we did not take her tongue.
Yeah.
But
so the insinuation is...
Well, he says they sent a cop to move the body. Maybe he did it as a warning to others.
So the insinuation is Hank did it.
But, like, that doesn't really hold water.
But neither does... This is what I kind of love about this episode. Yeah. Like, there's been a lot of confusion about the tongue, right? And I was trying to find the best way to articulate this as to the symbolism behind the tongue, right? Mm-hmm. And the best I could get is a quote from... And I took a screen grab of this because I was very proud of myself. Is a quote from famous Game of Thrones author George R.R. Martin. Mm-hmm. He says that when you tear out a man's tongue, you're not proving him a liar, but only telling the world that you fear what he might say. So the tongue in this season, like, I once again did a bit deep diving, and Issa Lopez has basically said the tongue symbolizes Anakin's voice.
That's how I took it. I hadn't read that. I'm just smart. Yeah.
No, literally, that's what it means. And as a result, it holds no more symbolism in this than that.
Yeah.
It's a cool effect. It's a kind of cool ghostly detail to put here. But she doesn't feel the need to answer that question at all. And you know what? I'm fine with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if it is, you know, presumably the spirit of Annie Kay, it is a way for her to speak, to say, like, you are on my case now.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when you were investigating the death of these men,
but you can, the thing is, you can tie all this, like you said before, no one, the whole season is the unreliable narrator. Like, this could very well, when we find out who the killers are, they could have easily, like, the tongue could have been cut out and put beside the body as a, you know, snitches get stitches sort of thing. And they could have found the body, taken that, and kept it as a one day when we find, we will place. Even though they, like, we'll get to it, even though the murderers claim that they don't know anything about the tongue, that doesn't necessarily mean they don't know anything about the tongue.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're right. Like, again, we can't be sure of this.
Yeah, it's but, like, it can be explained. It can be explained. It just can't be explained by virtue of someone in the episode saying they did or didn't.
Yes.
But, yeah, you could easily squirrel that way. So.
I like this moment very much as well, where Navarro says, say again that you loved Annie Kay.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I loved her. And as soon as he does, Navarro pulls her gun, and Danvers just turns around and is leaving.
Yeah.
And Navarro is like, aren't you going to try to stop me? And she's like, nope.
Nope.
Yeah. You do what you got
to
do.
She like, aren't you going to try and stop me this time? I think is what she says. And she's like, nope.
Like, and so we do get... We get some resolution on this of what happened in the Wheeler house, because Danvers leaves and we get the flashback again of the dude sitting in the chair whistling Twist and Shout. And Navarro comes back without having shot Clark, worth pointing out. And Danvers says, you know, I was about to do it when you shot him. Wheeler, I mean. And we get this moment that happens in the Wheeler house, where after, you know, he's grinning and whistling, and Danvers is kind of very slowly lifting her gun.
Yeah.
And before she can do it, Navarro just, like, pulls her gun and fires.
Yeah,
and
reflex. Yeah. Like, it's like, it's very, very, very quick.
And yeah, so we kind of wrap that up as far as...
Yeah, we also get the detail, although it's not really explained, we get the detail of a baby crying.
Yeah.
And once again, I've read a few things where this upset a few people because it's not actually parsed out. And what I took away from this is them fabricating the evidence is kind of twofold. One, it's... You know, it's them covering their tracks and putting a guy who clearly wasn't fucking... a nice dude, kind of putting a bow on that story. But the other thing I kind of took away from it was, is it easier for that kid to grow up thinking that their mother was murdered or their mother committed suicide?
Right, and their father, like, hey, you're, if the story is your mother was abused and murdered, yeah. and then your father killed himself because he could not live with it or whatever,
yeah,
then that's probably a better story than, hey, she committed suicide and then, oops,
yeah,
we got that a little wrong. We read the room a little wrong.
So yeah, I like that's how I took that. Once again, the internet. The internet's the internet.
So when we come back to Danvers, she's peeling an orange.
In a spiral, just exactly the same way that Navarro's mom used to peel them.
And the orange falls, and we get a moment where we see, like, frost on the ground where the tongue was.
Yeah.
And in a very funny moment, Danvers is like, This looks like a supernatural clue, Dr. Lecter. And then Navarro comes in and she rises up really quickly and bangs her head on the underside of the table and gives a good fuck, which I really like. But yes, she leaves a spiral behind on the plate, just like, you know, Navarro's mom and also the spiral that we keep seeing. She also grabs a bottle of Absolut on her way out, which is, you know, good for her.
Love it.
And they go to question Clark some more because the one thing we don't know is, okay, we know Annie Kay was killed there, but we still don't know what happened to the men.
Yeah, which, like, to me is all I've been screaming at my TV for about the past 10 minutes. So that, right. Fucking ask him about what happened in the...
So we do, and Clark says, like, he'd been seeing Annie Kay, and he knew that she was going to come for him.
Yeah.
And so when whatever happens.
Yeah.
You know. But
basically when he felt that presence and the power went out, he legged it.
Yes. To the shaft with the hatch.
Yeah, and got on the other side of the hatch, so in the tunnel underneath, and held on for dear life as he could hear the banging on top and these, like, the howling sounds and all the rest, all this commotion. And he claims that he is down there for days, which would track. I also love the fact that Danvers, like, suddenly puts it together. Like, this dude was here when we were here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, remember that he's been here the whole fucking time during this investigation. We didn't know about this thing. But also, he came out for food when the delivery driver came through. So he doesn't actually know what happened to his colleagues. He thinks the vengeful ghost of Annie Kay came and claimed them.
Right, and tried to open the hatch, like he was holding the hatch closed. And had gone to look for Otis Heiss to figure out how to survive Annie. And Danvers is like, well, that doesn't make any sense, Dr. Lecter, because, you know, he had quit long before that, and the event that he survived was long before Annie was even born.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when, and this, I think, is a little ham-fisted. This may be what you were talking about when he's like, yeah, but time is a flat circle, man, and we're just stuck in it.
Yeah. And that's, don't know how much of that, though. Like, this is, like, I think, go and listen to an interview with Issa Lopez. She's a very, very, very playful person, right? Mm-hmm. She's a big personality. And part of me does feel like she watched that first season. She fucking loved that first season. She maybe spent, I don't know, 5 minutes checking YouTube videos and she just saw how much of a cultural phenomenon that is and was like that. I'm going to fuck with it. So, like, it would not surprise me if that's a little... Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, kind of fine, right? Like... It's not my favorite line in the episode.
Yeah, it didn't upset me because they didn't handle it in the same way as it's handled in season one. Like, had they really went and, like, remember, like, season one, like, the time is a flat circle is all leading up to the fact that they end up hunting the wrong person.
Mm-hmm.
They end up killing the guy who is a murderer and is the meth cooker or whatever. That whole thing about the monster appearing and all the rest, that's where that comes from. That time is a flat circle, is that, like, the bodies are appearing again because we didn't do our job right and evil will come up like that. In the case of this one, it's a throwaway line by someone who's mentally broken, who is, like, a well-read in the... I believe that Clark read Nietzsche more than I believe that fucking... you know, some of these backwoods hillbillies have read fucking books on Carcosa. You know what I mean? It's like, so I, like, it didn't bother me. I just kind of felt like it's the obvious line to take from season one. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know if he said, like, if I can smell it in the psychosphere, that would have more of an impact. I'd be like, whoa. But, you know, it's clumsy, but it's not fucking the continental line in the year, isn't it? The worst thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, one false note in this episode is not going to throw me off.
No, of course not.
But sure enough, Danvers leaves on that note, and Clark tells Navarro, like, go ahead and kill me or let me do it.
Yeah.
Danvers, meanwhile, goes to lie down in one of the, you know, crew quarters or whatever, mm-hmm. and finds a crucifix in her hair.
Mm-hmm.
So, supernatural shit afoot.
Yeah, for those not keeping count, the crucifix is the symbol of Navarro's mother, mm-hmm. Which has appeared several times in this season thus far in weird situations. But this, to me, shows that it's kind of the supernatural element is now crossing over. Like, so this is, at the moment, so far, most of the supernatural stuff, if not all of it, has happened to Navarro. And that's including the stuff that affects Danvers. Mm-hmm. So Holden communicating and all the rest. This is the first time, like, we are so close to whatever event that's actually affecting Danvers. So Danvers is finding something that she can't, you know, can't square away, because how could she?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, and we'll come back to this, the whole question of the supernatural in this. Mm. But there is a pretty good shot of Pete taking the bodies out to visit Rose. Dude. As the street lights are going out, which is very cool. It's right, just a
Rose
great shot.
Rose in this episode as well. I'm just like,
man, she, like, Rose keeps it real. And that's what I like about her.
It's gonna be one of those nights, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, we're almost there. So Danvers, meanwhile, wakes up from, like, this dream vision where she sees her boy Holden,
mm-hmm.
and then hears him scream mommy, and then she wakes up, and the first thing we realize is, like, oh, she can see her breath here, and the power is out in the station, and the temperature's fallen fast.
Yes.
And, you know, if as soon as the fires go out, we're not going to survive. Maybe we shouldn't. But Danvers goes to find Navarro.
We do see her breath, though, so she can't be the thing.
That's right. Navarro, on the other hand.
I don't know.
But she goes to find Navarro and finds her outside, where Clark is now frozen and dead.
Yeah, he's what we like to call pulling a Torrance.
Yeah, it is. And then, you know, some swing music plays and we see him in a picture.
He's always in the gold room in 1921, Bo. I don't know if you knew that.
Yes, he's always been the caretaker at Salal.
Well, the thing is, like, she thinks Navarro forced him out mm-hmm. to freeze to death. And this is where everything gets a little bit esoteric, a little bit spooky, from the other side, Bo.
Yeah, I like that the way she puts it is, that frozen motherfucker out there is only witness we have, Dr. Lecter. And Navarro's like, I didn't do that to him.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't make him go out there.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I found him. And, by the way, I'm going to go find a backup generator because it's getting fucking cold.
Yeah.
And so she goes to work on the generator, which doesn't start, but we do get a good glimpse of Annie Kay, all ghostly behind her.
Mm-hmm.
And then upstairs, Danvers is getting some ghosts of her own when this busted hubcap rolls by the doorway as she's looking out.
Yeah.
And then we cut back down to Navarro, who is now seeing the ghost of Clark mm-hmm. that's doing the whole, like, shudder thing and says, she's awake, which suggests that, oh, he is the kind of ghost that is just repeating what's happened in the past.
Yeah.
So, you know, of the three kinds of ghosts, we have the one that just repeats,
yep.
which is Clark here.
Mm-hmm.
We have the one that is trying to give a message, even if you don't want to hear it, which is Holden.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got the ghost
trying to take you with you.
Right, which seems to be Julie.
Yes.
But we'll get to that in a second. But
yes.
So, all right. So Pete then shows up at Rose's place. And this is where he's like, hey, I need you to take me where Julia is. I've got somebody who's going the same place. And yeah. That's the point where she says, it's going to be one of those nights.
One of those put two bodies on ice nights.
No. Rose has a line that I'm like, what the fuck have you been up to, Rose? Like,
yeah.
She knows a little, but we'll get to this. Anyway, so yeah. Navarro and Danvers are now huddled around a fire.
Mm.
And because there's no power in the place and they're just trying to stay alive until the storm lets up. And they can get out of this place. And Navarro says, you know, there's just something out there that's calling me. And I just want to tell you that, you know, when I see Holden...
Yeah, well, she says that there's something out there that's calling me, and then she goes to talk about her sister, and, like, Jodie Foster lays in hard that your sister was weak, she couldn't handle it, you're strong, you can handle it, you don't walk out on the ice. This is about to 180 pretty quick in this episode.
Yeah.
She will turn on that statement pretty fast, because she does say she's like that, you know, she said, it looks like you across the eyes, but... Something like that.
Yeah, he doesn't look like you much, but there's something about his eyes.
Yeah.
And she's like, what the fuck are you talking about, Dr. Lecter? Yeah. And she's like, well,
Holden, he told me a message. And she, Danvers goes fucking raw here.
Dude, she gets like not mama bear. She gets like fucking violent. She's like, you shut up. You shut your mouth. You keep his name out of your mouth. And she says, and I wrote this down because it was such a good quote. It's one. Yeah. This is the delivery that I love. This may be my favorite thing Jodie Foster has ever said. The line is, shut up about him or I'll shoot your sick fucking mouth right off your face. Fuck. She is angry. And then she says, I am not merciful. I have no mercy left. You understand? And then storms off. When she looks at Navarro and says, I am not merciful.
Yeah.
It's like, fuck, she is not lying to you.
Yeah.
She is telling you the God's truth right now, and you need to accept that you need to back the fuck off.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, Leah is trying to get hold of Danvers. Quick cutaway where she's like, hey, whatever's going on, don't die out there, okay?
Yeah.
And... So we kind of follow Danvers from there, who goes to this room again, and she buries herself under blankets, and she's like trying to stay warm.
Well, as part of her storming off, she basically says to Navarro, like, if you want to walk out at night, you fucking go. Or that, right. Like, yeah, she threatens her. She goes in, she puts things over, and instantly is like that. She might do it. I was angry, but that's maybe not the thing that someone who is contemplating suicide may want to hear. So she gets back up, she heads down, and the fire's still on, but ain't no Navarro, bo.
Yep, so she goes outside to hunt for Navarro, who is, sure enough, walking out on the ice, but from Navarro's point of view, she's in the desert.
Yeah.
And we get, like, the ear bleeding again, which suggests she is in the presence of this whatever it is that's out there on the ice. And the thing gives her name, which is like Senna Hitchcock, something like that.
It's better than what I had, so go for it.
And Danvers sees Holden under the ice beneath her feet.
Yeah.
And so she starts freaking out because, like, the kid is banging from under the ice.
Yeah.
And she's like, Holden, and then starts banging on the ice. And sure enough, shoots down through the ice.
Ice is going to break. And it does, actually, and she goes into the ice, and the fucking cinematography in this scene is fucking beautiful. It's, like, absolutely mind-blowingly good. But, yeah, she goes under and, for all intents and purposes, dies. And, once again, according to Issa Lopez, that character dies in the ice, but is brought back by Navarro, who doesn't walk out any further on the ice. She gets her native name, and then she goes back, she helps Danvers, and she gets her in. And I will tell you this, Jodie Foster's acting is so fucking good that the raspy tone she's getting as she's being brought back to life, I genuinely thought someone had killed Jodie Foster and brought her back to life. Like, that's how, like, it sounds like she, like, I don't even know how you, I used to do
so good
death metal vocals in a band, and the rasp that she gets in her voice, I couldn't do, right? It's just this kind of, sort of the breathing, like how someone breathes when they can't get enough air into their lungs. And Navarro's trying to bring her like back, like desperately trying to bring her back. And she asks, in this kind of stupor of half alive, half dead, she asks her what Holden said to her. And Navarro says, Holden says, like, I see you. And it's like, this fucking acting is so good. It's like the weight of everything like comes right off the top of Danvers, and she cries in a way which feels maybe the most realistic crying I've seen since fucking like Florence Pugh in Midsommar, or fucking Toni Collette in like fucking Hereditary. It's just this kind of hollowed out growly howl. It's just so fucking emotional,
and Navarro just holds her and lets her cry. I mean, it's a really wonderful moment between these characters.
I think it's the bit where I think, because what you're going to get after this is an acceptance, where I think Danvers, all that front that she's had about, like, you know, did your spirit guide tell you, and all that, that kind of goes in this moment. And I think she respects that maybe there are things out there, maybe death isn't the final part of the story. So,
well, I mean, she's just seen Holden, she's just seen her son. But sure enough, the storm is passing. Pete's still digging out on the ice, though.
This is fun. This is like Rose. Right, like, he's like, he finishes digging, he's like, right, that should be enough. And like, Rose is like, with the fucking the knife, and he's looking at it. She's like, you may want to turn your head just now. And he's like, no, I want to see. And she's like, you want to see is I fucking puncture your dad's lungs here so he doesn't fucking float. And you see it, he's like, Pete's face is like, yeah, maybe I don't want it. Like, so he turns around.
Yeah.
And Rose, like, full on has buried bodies before in the past. Right.
Has had to have done something, because she knows how to do this quick and efficiently. And the fact that she knew how to do it at all, or that it needed to be done.
I never even thought of that.
Yeah.
Like, she's like, she knows that if they put the, there's another aspect to consider here. Like, she knows, like, the police know that, to be honest, fucking Pete should have known. The ice is, or the ice in the water is so cold, it's going to preserve the body, right? And when the ice thaws, that body's going to come up. And you don't want that, like, you don't want that to happen. So naturally, you puncture the lungs, it removes all the air from the body, and it makes your body float. Sink. So she, I love that she does that, though. But then Rose is like, but I'm not putting them in the ice. You need to do that, because you need to finish what you started on this. That Rose will help you get the body ready. Rose ain't helping you put the body in the ice.
I think that has something to do with, like, Navarro telling Danvers, you know, like, you get to carry Annie now. You know, it's that kind of thing. Like, you're now responsible for
I think there's a finality to that you have to do. It's like that. It's like in Lake Mungo, the premise of Lake Mungo, if you're looking at it from a non-ghostly point of view, is the reason the mother so wholly believes that her kid might be communicating from beyond the dead is because she never saw the body. She never went to see the body. Her husband did. So there's a part of her that, because she never saw it, it was never real to her. So this idea of Pete needs to put his dad into the ice, which, by the way, they juxtapose, like, when he's digging the ice and you get the juxtaposition of the shot of, like, Hank drilling the ice to save his son from that memory, is fucking chef's kiss. You know, your dad dug through the ice to save your life, you're digging the ice to bury your fucking dad. It's just so good, man. But yeah, Pete puts him in there. Like, Pete's just like, oh, well, that's the worst of that. Like, fucking.
Yeah, Rose is like, oh, let me just check you right now. Wait, she sits down and she says, yep, you're probably thinking the worst part's done. It's not.
Yeah.
What comes after? Forever? That's the worst part.
So, like, there's a couple of ways to look at this, right? The easiest, most superficial way of looking at this is that he has to live with the fact that he killed his dad, mm-hmm. right? And has, like, not killed his dad, but hidden his dad. And this case will never be solved. Like, Hank's body's never going to be found. It'll never be solved. The other way to look at it is when people die in Ennis, they come back as ghosts. And there could be a very literal meaning of, Hank's probably going to come back as a ghost now. And if he's going to visit anyone, most likely going to visit you. So it's just something you're going to have to kind of get used to.
You've done the work to earn your ghostly visit from Hank, the ghost of murder past.
Yeah, who'll play like sing his song of doom and gloom and God foreboding and paint your rooms blue. Mm-hmm.
But then they look up at the sky and the Aurora Borealis is shining above them.
And I love this. Like, the storm's over and it comes up right on the screen. 1st of January.
January 1st, 15th day of night. And then we go back to Salal where Navarro and Danvers are looking out the window and they see the storm has passed. They're like, hey, we can go now.
Yeah.
And there's a great moment where Danvers is like, hey, happy new year, Dr. Lecter.
Yeah,
and
they've got some whiskey there.
And Danvers, like, in as close as we get to like a genuinely emotional moment between these characters, Danvers says, "If you ever do go for that walk, Dr. Lecter, try to come back."
Yeah,
and Navarro's like, "Yeah, I got to do something because the whole time I felt like Navarro hanging on, I felt like Clark holding on to that hatch while something above me is trying to open it." Mm-hmm. And immediately Danvers is like, "What the fuck did you just say?" And she's like, "Yeah, that I feel like Clark hanging on to the latch." And she's like, "Shut up, we gotta go do a thing." And then she goes like, makes she basically makes some like homemade luminol.
Yeah, homemade luminol and chemicals that, like, I love Jodie Foster. And she's like, she doesn't carefully spray it on. She pours this motherfucker all over the hatch.
And she's like,
get a UV light.
Right. She's not fucking around. And then, sure enough, as you know, you brought up the last episode.
Three fingers.
One of the handprints is missing fingers. And that's where we get Foster saying, "We were asking the wrong question, Dr. Lecter. Not who killed Annie Kay, but who knows who killed her?"
Yeah.
And then, Duncan, we drive to the end of the episode.
We literally jump in a car and drive to the end of the episode.
which is a woman named Beatrice, the cleaner that we talked to, the one who said, they don't pay any attention. Which, by the
way, like this all, it makes so much sense. The introduction to this character was she'd beaten the shit out of this guy because he'd laid his hands mm-hmm. on the woman with three fingers. So she fucking laid him out.
And then about halfway...
She is Lady Justice. She is being shot. She's the Dark Knight, bro.
Well, and she's also the one who said, when they're asking about the Salal station, and she's like, nobody ever talked to us because nobody talks to the cleaners.
Yeah, she's also the character when we're like, does this symbol mean anything to you? She's like, Blair, does this mean... she's been all the way through this series. She's been, they've spoken to her more than once. We've been down to see them more than once. These characters have appeared more than once. The evidence was there on the clothes out in the ice of someone with three fingers. But we, very much like the detectives, were never asking the right question, Bo, and we disregarded plain fucking evidence in front of our eyes. So they arrive at our house, and this scene is fucking amazing because it starts off with just Beatrice and the woman with three fingers, right? And they're like, can we come in and talk to you? And like, yep.
At first it's Jodie Foster, and then she introduces herself. Go on now. And yeah, go on now. We'll take care of her. And it's Navarro who introduces herself.
Well, she, like, Angeline. Beatrice had asked before about what her name was, and she didn't know. So. Yeah,
and she says, my name is Angeline, Sinichkak Navarro.
Yeah.
And the woman's like, Sinichkak, that was my Aka's name. And Navarro says, well, do you know what it means? And Beatrice tells her, well, it means the return of the sun after the darkness. Mm. And then she kind of more readily invites them in. It's like, okay, yeah. now that we've established that, let's have a seat. And
now that we've established that, let's tell you how everything went down.
Yeah.
Right.
And she says, yeah, well, you know, here's the thing. I can tell a story.
Yeah.
But now whether this is how it happened, who's to say?
This is one of the clue endings.
Right.
Like, it could have happened this way, but maybe it happened like this.
And she says, hey, because of the way that Native people are treated, it's the same story over and over again. And she says, so we decided we were gonna tell our own story, and this is how our story goes. Which is, after spilling some mop water at the Salal station and seeing it go down this hatch, she goes down and discovers the weapon that killed Annie Kay. They also find these documents that were the documents that Annie Kay was looking for that proves that Salal was not just covering up pollution. They were encouraging the mine to pollute more so that they could soften the permafrost and get their samples.
It also proves that scientists don't learn from their mistakes. I'd change tools. I would have locked away that material, but I don't know, maybe tidied up my notes. Done some things just in case this ever happens again, we have to murder another woman. Maybe we put some steps in, like a padlock on the latch. Or something. But yeah, so they find out. But I love this because there's a network of cleaners.
And Danvers asks her, like, well, why didn't you report all this? And she says, well, because nothing would have changed. This is the story we know, is that we do this thing and nothing changes. So we told them, we told ourselves another story.
Yeah.
And
so
this
we get a cleaner actually in the police station, cleaner. She's looking through the crime scene thing. She's matching the wounds to to make sure they're right here. They're working it through. So yeah, essentially they set up everything. But while they're telling this story, while she's telling this story, more women start coming in. One at a time.
Yep. Until there's a dozen people in this room.
Yeah.
Besides the cops.
Yeah. And because you're thinking, so how could they overpower these seven guys? Well, it turns out, Bo, if there's a dozen of you and you know where everything is in a facility, you can just walk in and switch the fucking power off.
Turn off the power, show up with some guns, and they basically just herd them into the back of a truck.
Yeah.
And
meanwhile, they see the main scientist try and get in the hatch, so they know someone's in the hatch, which is how the handprints get there. They're basically trying to, you know, jimmy the hatch up, but they couldn't do it, so that explains the noise there. But they basically herd them into a fucking container in a vehicle and drive them out into the middle of the snow.
And so they say, well, so in this story, you killed them. And she's like, no, we didn't kill them. Yeah. They killed themselves when they killed her daughter in her home.
Yeah.
They woke her up. What we did is we forced the men to strip and then march them toward her and put the spirals on their heads and shit like that.
So this is the they're talking about is the entity that Darwin drew right at the beginning. It's not Sengar, whatever it is, but basically the entity that doesn't have any fingers bleeds from them, that is goddess of the sea and fish and all the rest. And they're like that. We marched them out there. Their clothes were there.
Yeah.
They wanted at any time they could have come back and put their clothes on, or she could claim them. And turns out she claimed them.
Yeah. The way she puts it, because again, another great fucking line. Yeah. Because Danvers, I think, is the one who asks, so they didn't come back. Why don't you think they came back then? And she says, well, I guess she ate their fucking dreams from the inside out and spit their frozen bones. But that's just a story. It's like, oh, man, that is one of the most metal things I've ever heard. Somebody having their fucking dreams eaten from the inside out and spit out their frozen bones. And so after saying this, there's a real pregnant pause between them of all right, what's the next move?
Yeah, there's a real pregnant pause of there's 12 women who have just told us a story about how they fucking, like, basically sent 7 murderers to their death, and there's 2 of us. And we're a little bit outnumbered here. What I love about this, mm-hmm. Danvers is fucking character is so good, man. And like, she's like, she has the Ripley response to this, mm-hmm. you know, like, we'll just nuke it from orbit just to be sure. Like, she's like that. Well, we just wanted to come here and tell you that the case is closed. It was an Arctic landslide, and that's what killed the scientists. And we just thought, because they were your employers and employed you cleaning up there, that you just might want to know about that.
Yeah.
The level of genius fuckery here that Danvers pulls off is 5D chess, right? Because basically what she's doing is she is using the mine forced the police to close this case with a bullshit reasoning, right, to fuck Danvers and that investigation over. And by the very same token, she's going to burn down the fucking mine, mm-hmm. right, when this information comes out, which we'll get more real as to how they're going to do that. But when, like, she's sitting on the, we know stuff that this has been doing and all the rest. And you know what? I can just close this case as well. And I'll just use the same bullshit because you've closed it for me. So mm-hmm. nice and easy. I know what happened. Justice has been served in this story.
And they look, so Danvers gives up the, like, well, we just thought you'd be interested, Dr. Lecters. Yeah. And
like, she gets ready. So she basically goes out, but like, if you're me and Navarro in this case, like, you're like that. So the tongue. Like,
well, first Navarro says, because they ask her, like, what do you think about this? And she says, you know, stories are stories. Everybody's got them. That's fine. And, but yeah, so Beatrice gives her, like, this really, like, friendly pat, like, hey, uh-huh. you know, you're kind of one of us sort of thing.
Yeah.
And, but yes, that's where Navarro asks about the tongue. And she's like, I don't have any idea.
Yeah, did you put the tongue there so we'd link the cases or whatever? And she's like that. Know anything about, there's nothing about a tongue in our story.
Yeah. And which, again, you know, this is the realm of the unreliable narrator. Does she not? Who knows?
Yeah.
But then we get kind of our coda on this whole story, which takes place on March 12th, the first long day of the year. It's the first sunshine we've seen since the beginning of the first episode, which is...
Yeah, and we get a very True Detective trope that has not been all the way in this one. We get the interview of the police officer who attended the thing, which I kind of love this. Mm-hmm. I kind of love being in this. Because also, if you've watched True Detective, like that season that everyone loves as well, that show opens with the detective being interviewed. So mm-hmm. I kind of love that this one closes with a detective being interviewed in Sunshine, and it's Danvers, and she's been interrogated by 2 guys that just want to know what happened a couple of months ago.
Right, yeah, like internal investigations or whatever.
Well, primarily they're trying to work out what happened with Otis Heiss and Hank.
Right, and she says, well, you know, based on all observations, it seems like it was a deal gone bad, Dr. Lecter, where Otis and Hank must have gotten into a scrape, and then he killed Otis, and in the attempt to hide that body, he disappeared.
Because Hank is fucking useless. Hank has been caught on camera following Danvers from the lighthouse. Fucking moron.
Right. And she says, you know, well, it, you know, we'll find the bodies in the spring. We always do.
Yeah.
Always unless do. We don't.
Unless you don't. Like,
yeah. And then this is where Pete comes in, bringing her coffee.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, as you know, this is his son. He was out looking for his father. And we all feel, you know, pretty touched about that, Dr. Lecter. Mm-hmm. And then they ask her, well, don't you think it's kind of strange that Clark died exactly like all the others, kind of on your watch?
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, it is odd. Yes. It is very strange. But, you know, some questions just don't have answers, Dr. Lecter.
Yeah.
And then they're like, all right, fine. But what about Navarro?
Yeah.
And she's like, well, you know, some people come to Alaska to escape something. And while she's telling them, you know, getting the VO.
While she's telling them that line, we get, while she's telling them her story.
Yes. The real story is she goes to Navarro's place, finds only this stuffed bear.
Yeah.
We cut over to Kavik, who finds his toothbrush brought back to him.
Yeah.
And Danvers is like, you know, some people are looking for something. And, you know, I believe that Evangeline Navarro found what she was looking for. And it's Navarro, like, we get a cut to her just staring off into the wilds of Alaska.
Yeah.
And just starting off. But back at her house, there is a phone that has a video confession from Clark saying, here is the shit that we pulled along with Silver Sky Mines.
Yeah.
And we get a quick shot of, like, a native dude who's just
kind of... did from the very beginning.
Yes.
The dude that was hunting the caribou or whatever it was, right in the very opening scene. But this time, he's walking past just, like, an abandoned mine. Like, it's been closed. The government closed this fucker down quick.
And they're like, so you've seen the... they're asking Danvers, these investigators, so you've seen the Clark video? And she's like, well, sure. Who hasn't seen the Clark video, Dr. Lecter? But no, who leaked it? I don't know. Somebody did, but who knows?
Yeah.
And they're like, well, what are you going to do next? And she says, look, this is Ennis. This town is, it was here before we got here. It was here before this place was even called Alaska. Yeah. It's going to be here after us. So I'm going to show up and I'm going to do my job. What else is there, Dr. Lecter? And then we just...
well, they ask about... could she explain how people claim that they still see Navarro from time to time? Like, kind of the insinuation being that she might live out on the ice. But that's not how I take this, because at the very end of this one, we get a shot of her and Leah, who, and they've kind of grown together now. Uh-huh. Like, they're eating sandwiches and laughing in a car. Mm-hmm. And we go to Danvers' home at the end.
Well, no, first there's Pete. He was sleeping with his kid, but there's an expression on his face that says he is fucked for life.
Yeah, he's like, he now clocks in and clocks out. You know what I mean? He ain't doing anything above what he needs to. He is no longer asking the right questions. He's doing the bare minimum for his job and holding on tightly to his family, holding on, clinging to his son. And then we jump to Danvers. And like at home, out on our balcony, and as she's sitting on our balcony, Navarro appears as an apparition, standing at the side, smiling at her, leading you to believe that maybe she committed suicide, or maybe she didn't.
And right. Well, all right. So two things. Well, in the last lines of the whole season are when she says, when they ask her, like, do you think that people are seeing Navarro out there? And she says, I believe that eventually Navarro is not out on that ice, but this is Ennis. Nobody ever really leaves, Dr. Lecter. And that's where we get this moment of them on the deck. And so I'm of two minds about this. Here's what I truly believe, is that, yes, this is an apparition that she sees but not in an unfriendly way. Like, this is not, this is that comfort that Navarro kind of talks about. Like, there's something bigger out there, and you can take some comfort for that because... you know, Holden is watching now, theoretically. Navarro is kind of watching and looking out for Danvers.
Yep. And she did what she was asked. Like,
right, come back.
Danvers said to her, if you go out in the ice, come back.
Yeah.
And I think that come back is not a literally, physically come back, and it's more a spiritually don't leave.
Right. And so the other read that I haven't read up on this, but it's just one of those things of like, oh, okay, I could see where this could be uninterpreted.
They say on the show that people go out and live on the ice.
Yes.
We've already met three characters that lived in, like, compounds out there. So it's also totally believable that she lives a life off the fucking grid.
And we also know that... this is where my read of it gets a little strange. We also know that Navarro is bisexual.
Yes.
And so there is a read for me where, oh, this is just them ultimately ending up together as a couple.
Yeah.
Because there's no... all right, so Duncan, here's the thing I fucking love about this episode. Is that could be true. It could be a spirit. We don't fully understand exactly what happened at the car accident with Jodie Foster and the kid. We just know that it's haunted her.
Yep.
Even though we got answers to the Wheeler thing, there are still questions about what that what kind of psychic damage that still has for Navarro or Danvers.
We never found out what the woman whose head was blown off in the war scene said to Navarro. Right. What did she whisper? We don't get, and you know what, Bo? I don't think everything needs to be like
100%, 100%. Because, you know, like, it's what Danvers says, like, not everything has a clean answer. Mm-hmm. And I like the fact that there's sort of this messiness of, yeah, apparently there is something supernatural out on the ice.
Yeah.
Like, that is the reason, like, there's no other explanation even hinted at in the show other than, like, hey, there was pollutants and stuff like that. But that's, like, there is more direct evidence for the supernatural than there is of that. At least,
and this is how I know that, like, true detective fans, you know, the hardcore ones, just don't get horror, right, at all. Because if you've seen Tigers Are Not Afraid, there is a ton of, like, this is actually a very Tigers Are Not Afraid ending.
Right, it's that level, like, of ambiguity of, like, yeah, was there magic or not? Yes.
Spirituality and all the rest that's wrapped up, and some things are just bigger than us.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, yeah, I really adored the ending of this. Yeah. I thought it was kind of heartfelt,
mm-hmm,
in a way that I almost didn't expect it to be as, like, poignant as, yeah, it was, even though...
It's her pedigree. That's what she does. Yeah. Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, her previous work to this is Tigers Are Not Afraid, which it was a movie that I was in cinema with grown men who were fucking crying.
Yeah.
Like, that's how powerful she does it. And the choice of score, the way it's set up, Jodie Foster's delivery of those lines at the very end. It's just there. And I think you come at the end of this and you didn't like this. I just don't think you like TV, if I'm honest.
Yeah,
I mean, don't get the complaint of anyone, yeah, that says this is awful, which is what I've read. Like, this is awful TV. This is an awful season. Like that, I just don't, like, I don't think you ever came into this with an open mind, like, at all. You think you came in wanting the thing that you saw a decade ago? You know what I mean? That first season of True Detective, it's a decade ago. Like, that's what you wanted. And I just don't, to me, this one, weirdly, is the most heartfelt out of all of them. Maybe takes the crown of season three. Season three ended with a very emotional end, with him out with his family and friends, and everyone's all there together, and they're having a barbecue on the porch, and he sees everyone, like his daughters come back to him and all the rest. I mean, I'm looking at this and I'm like, that, this one has more ambiguity than that. It has more heart.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fucking great ending to me. Like, as reads go, I think Navarro died. I think in the last scene she's wearing the same clothes that she was wearing when she walked out into the ice. Like, that was my take on it. But I love the idea that she's there with her at the end, however that is, in person, as a partner, or as a spirit. I fucking love the ending. I think it lands so strong. This is one of those ones that, you know, it's a gymnast doing all those flips and twirls that don't mean shit if they don't land with 2 feet stationary in the ground at the end. They're going to get marked down. And this one, it might be messy, it may have missed a couple of grabs, but this season landed 2 feet fucking square on the mat at the end. So, loved it.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, terrific season. As always, a great time. Well, you know, as for what comes next, we'll figure it out. We got some Pink Panther. We got there's a whole season of Slasher we haven't touched
yet. We might have to do Slasher first, because the thought of going off and watching, I don't know, some Inspector Clouseau, finding a bit of joy in my life, and then having to sit down and do Slasher is just like, it's a pain that I don't want. So we may have to just rip the Band-Aid off, get right through fucking Slasher, and then get, like, some joy at the end of it. I don't know, but
we'll figure it out though, soon rather than later. And we've got,
feels good to be back though, and hopefully the listeners out there have enjoyed our take, and we are in a position now that we can very comfortably say that DBCC will be back, and in our horizon future we have a new season of The Terror that's been commissioned that we will cover, and a new season of True Detective, which, by the way, we will also cover.
That, yes, exactly right. So, I gotta tell you, just
you have to tell me.
No. I was just gonna say, like, through sheer attrition, it turns out that the third episode is still the highest rated of this season so far.
Mm.
But I predict that the finale is going to be a banger.
I predict a riot.
Well, look, we'll just see how the votes turn out. You know what I'm saying? I've got water. I'm storing water now. That's where I am. That's why I got the second dog, just for protection. Although, based on everything I've seen so far,
yeah,
not much protection.
No,
very, very. I'm about to have to give him a bath. That's about to be the thing that happens. So, yes, Duncan, where can people find more out of you between now and when next we talk here on DBCC?
You can find me on Podcast Under the Stairs, tputscast.com, wherever you listen to your podcast, Podcast Under the Stairs, and on YouTube. The next big thing from me will be a lot of talk and a lot of coverage in the next week and a half of Glasgow Fright Fest, where I will be taking in 11 horror movies. And for some reason, I did not notice this. The festival is opening on the Friday with the brand new film from the French duo behind Inside and Levide, who are coming out with a movie called, I think it's called The Soul Eater, which I was like, okay, if you say so.
And it's about a 9-to-5 job in an office.
Amen, brother. Yeah, amen. Right? I'll be doing a little bit of a chat on that one, which I'm very much looking forward to, because you never really know what you're going to get from Fright Fest. Some of it's good, some of it's bad, some of it is a bit iffy. Let me give you a little rundown on the synopsis for the movie, though. See if it tickles your fancy. This is the UK premiere. The Soul Eater. Two detectives with entirely different work methods are sent to a sleepy French mountain town of whatever French name that is. This could be a True Detective.
I was just thinking, this sounds very True Detective.
One is investigating a series of gruesome deaths. The other is searching for some missing local children. Soon, they realize that their cases are connected by an old folklore legend of a malevolent creature, the terrifying incarnation of the Soul Eater. From co-directors Julien Moret and Alexandra Bastillo, who, as part of the vanguard of French extreme cinema, brought you Inside, Levide, Among the Living, and The Deep House, now they unleash their most devilish and sinister creation, yet to shock horror and surprise. It contains apparently bloody murder imagery, torture, child endangerment, sexual violence, and consistent threat. So Inside.
Right. All of my favorites.
So yeah, so I'll feed back on that. So there you go.
All right.
What about you, Bo? What you got coming up?
Coming up soon, we are about to launch into some Asian horror on Dark Parade. A fairly obscure Kiyoshi Kurosawa film called Sweet Home.
I have never seen Sweet Home. I will be super curious about that one, because I love Kiyoshi Kurosawa's work.
So the reason it apparently it's getting a remaster, and one of its claims to fame is that apparently the director of the video game, Resident Evil, said that it was the inspiration for that game.
Oh, wow.
So I am curious to see it on a number of levels, thanks to that. So that's coming up. And then, you know, other dumb shit. Well, it just keeps going. More dumb stuff. Oh, a new Heart of Horror. We're going to do Near Dark. That's recording tomorrow.
Oh, nice.
And talking, you know, because it's an excuse to come up with a theme, right? And so we're going to be talking about going on vacation with a loved one or potential loved one, and how that's usually a terrible idea. So that's coming up. And, check that on Dark Parade. In the meantime, Duncan, the only thing left to do for this season of True Detective is to say to my good friend Duncan, say goodnight, Duncan.
To my good friend Duncan, say goodnight, Duncan.
Nice.